Stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive! Been great today, isn't it?
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another Deepest Lore. This is going to be a much shorter show than usual today, my friends. In fact, it may even be a shorter 10 minutes long. We'll see. I am expecting a guest here at the lodge. When that guest arrives, I will stop. So any super chats that are sent in, I will read out later on in the week. However, rather than leave your Monday afternoon fallow, I thought I would provide the extra details on the Vince McMahon expansion that I talked about 2 weeks ago. A number of people have asked me, you know, where is that? I mentioned that I did a very deep dive after I did that stream, just to fill in a couple of details that I wasn't quite sure of. And I have now got some of those extra details, so to speak. So I'm just going to, just if you remember, we're back in 1983, 1984, and the map of the territories look like this, okay? And when Vince started his expansion, if you remember, all of these territories were fallow. They'd already died away. Detroit had died. The old Amarillo Funk's territory was gone. The Phoenix territory, which nobody much talks about anyway, was gone. LA had gone, and Shires had shut up shop in San Francisco, which means that the key opponents for Vince during his expansion with Vern Gagne in the AWA, who was actually independent from the NWA. He was respected, but the AWA was not part of the National Wrestling Alliance. Okay. Bill Watts in Mid-South was another kind of independent promoter. There used to be a territory in the Mid-South area run by the Nick Gulas, and they had shut up shop, and Bill Watts had basically picked up the mantle because there was a void in that territory. And Watts, the cowboy, great wrestling brain, ran Mid-South instead of Gulas. So he's another rival. Then there's Jerry Jarrett and Jerry the King Lawler, who was the ace down in Memphis, who ran a very strong TV show in that market. They were a rival to Vince. And, of course, the Crockett's, who ran the Mid-Atlantic territory there, and later on they also ran Georgia and Florida as well, because they were also expanding. They had Ted Turner behind them, and eventually, of course, Turner bought out the Crockett's, and that became WCW. okay, so those are the major power brokers here. And there were just a few details when I was running through these dates that kind of puzzled me, and I thought I'd add a bit of flair, if you want a flair for the gold. Woo! No, not that sort of flair. Kind of knowledge flair. I dug deep. I consulted various newsletters. I consulted various old friends of mine that I knew, that I know in wrestling circles, who also done deep dives in this area, to basically get the inside scoop on what the hell was happening when Vince was running some of these shows. So LA was fallow. He started running there. The only bit of detail I've got on LA is that when he was running that in 1984, Hulk Hogan was used as a kind of battering ram to break the LA market. He you know, because he was from Venice Beach, and you know, he talked continually about coming home, and he talked about the Olympic, in promos, Hogan would talk about the Olympic Auditorium being like Hogan's new playground or the Hogan Arena type thing. So he used his kind of connection with the LA area to break that market. Then with St. Louis, kind of some interesting things happened. As I mentioned, Sam Muchnick retired, and that territory, the TV part, the Wrestling at the Chase TV slot in particular, and also the associated contract, the Kiel Auditorium, was sold to Larry Matisik, who had been a TV commentator. He was involved in that because Matisik had some involvement with the TV station in St. Louis, okay? But the actual territory had been taken over by the Central States office. That was Bob Geigel, who ran Kansas, and also Harley Race down there as well. And we'll come back to that because they were pretty pissed off about this. And when Vince started to run Kansas, there's a bit of after. So I'll come back to that story. Detroit, we covered last time. That was basically dead, and it took Vince years to revive the territory after the Sheik, who was a massive star in the 60s and 70s, but he did burn out the territory towards the end of the 70s. And it took Vince best part of a decade to build up Detroit as a wrestling market again. Then there was Sacramento. Now Montreal, there was a bit of detail on Montreal I didn't know, which was that old-time wrestling fans will remember a kind of posh English character called Lord Alfred Hayes. Lord Alfred Hayes. He was a TV commentator, he was like a kind of C-team announcer. He'd sometimes do like the Gene Okerlund slot on like C-show television programming. He was a mainstay of the Coliseum home videos and formed a kind of like C-team with Sean Mooney, if you remember him. So that was Lord Alfred Hayes. Well, apparently Lord Alfred Hayes was the WWF's point man for Montreal from the moment they kind of started getting involved with the territory, with that area, up until they were completely running Montreal. So I didn't know that bit of detail. Also, of course, Pat Patterson, who was part of Vince McMahon's inner circle, he also had connections with Montreal, of course, being a French Canadian, and he had connections up there as well. So they used Lord Alfred Hayes and Pat Patterson to book venues and to book wrestlers in the Montreal area. I'm just trying to remember I'm just going to look up very quickly who the territory was in Montreal there. I want to say it was run by, this was the Quebecois territory that was run. There was a load of talent that came from there. Like Andre the Giant was from there originally. There was a guy called the Rougeau brothers came from there. Rick Martel, Dino Bravo. These were all guys who came from the French Canadian market. I want to say it was Grand Prix Wrestling. Is that what it was called? So there was some like situation there where through all of these connections, through Andre, through Pat Patterson, and through Lord Alfred Hayes, Vince basically started running Montreal. Whether it was directly against that old territory or in partnership with them, I'm not entirely sure. That was it. Lutte International, L-U-T-T International, run by Gino Brito. Andre had a stake in that territory. So obviously, you know, as Andre was a WWF talent, they have kind of mutual need to run arenas up there. Yes, it seems like there was a working agreement. And if you remember, the Rougeau brothers came in, Jacques Rougeau and Raymond Rougeau, in that old territory. And I think they came in with that, you know, as the Rougeau brothers, they came in as somehow as part of that deal as well. So that was a little bit later, but it seems like through just connections, basically, he ended up, Vince ended up taking over Montreal. Then this set of dates here in June 1984. Now, do you remember I said, like, how was Vince running Memphis, Louisville, and Nashville? Well, I learned a little bit about this because I was a little bit puzzled. This was basically a formal declaration of war by Vince against Jerry Jarrett and Jerry the King Lawler. If for years people had told Vince that rather than like try to destroy Memphis, he should try to use Memphis as a kind of feeding territory or as a kind of like little league to the WWF's major league. But maybe later on they did a bit of that. But here in 1984, Vince was just of a very kind of bloody mindset that you just wanted to run them out of town. It was a very strong TV market. And so he ran these shows in Memphis, in Louisville, and in Nashville. Now, apparently on the night that Vince ran this card in Memphis, Jerry Jarrett ran, like he basically called in every single favor going and ran an absolutely loaded and stacked card up against Vince so that he couldn't draw in Memphis. They did the same in Louisville and they did the same in Nashville. So basically, Vince got his ass kicked on these three dates. Like, I think the gates for each of those shows was 1,000 or less. Like, they basically didn't draw at all. And everybody went to the Jarrett shows, which were run head-to-head with massive promotion through the TV. So, essentially, Vince here in June 84 was sent packing, as far as I can tell. Basically, just, you know, got his ass kicked and didn't go back to that market for some time afterwards. You also have to remember that fans in that area were kind of conditioned to wrestling Memphis style. I mean, let me see if I can find that Memphis card from 1984 to June 1984 wrestling results to just give you an example of the sort of card that they ran. It was the Mid-South Coliseum, obviously, is what they ran. Let me just see, pick up the June card to see what was run against Vince there. Let me just have a look exactly when Vince ran. Hold on. If you ever want any wrestling results, by the way, historyofwwe.com basically has everything. So to find this set of results, for example, I'm going there and clicking on 1984, and I'm just doing a control F for Memphis, and I can see that they ran that Memphis show on at the convention center June 24th 1984. They had a crowd of 1,200. Okay, headline: Hulk Hogan defeated Moondog Rex. Had been a star in the Memphis area, which is probably why he ran that. They also ran SD Jones versus Lanny Keen, just nothing match. Jesse Ventura versus Billy Travis. Big John Studd won an 18-man battle royale, last eliminating Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant. So, you know, they were trying to stack the card a little bit. Hogan was there. Andre was there. Jesse Ventura was there. Big John Studd was there. These are all big stars. Mil Máscaras defeated Samula. I mean, Mil Máscaras was probably the world's most famous luchador. They ran Adrian Adonis and Dick Murdoch were on the card against the Moondogs. And they also ran Tito Santana and Jimmy Snuka. Snuka was a huge star in this era against Adonis and Murdoch. So, I mean, that's a pretty loaded card for this Memphis debut in 1984. And they drew 1,200. You know, for a card in 1984 with Andre, Hogan, the IC champion Tito Santana, Jimmy Snuka, and Jesse Ventura and Big John Studd in 1984, and it drew 1,200 people. That is a dismal, dismal return for Vince. Okay. Now, Memphis, what did they, right? Memphis ran the following night, same weekend, 25th of June, 1984, Star Wars, right? They called the event Star Wars, and they drew 10,032 people at the Mid-South Coliseum. Okay. This is basically wrestling wars now. This was the card. Pork Drop Cash and Scott Shannon versus the Scorpions, defeated the Scorpions. Dutch Mantel, Johnny Willott, and Mark Batten over Masao Ito, the Nightmare, and Keith Robertson. Okay. The Animal pinned Rick McGord. Jim Neidhart over Giant Fraser. Giant Fraser was later Uncle Elmer, you might remember him as, in WWF. The Rock and Roll Express, massive stars in this era, beat Lanny Poffo and Randy Savage. Okay, Macho Man Randy Savage there made his name in Memphis. That was a big match. Rock and Rolls versus Randy Savage and his brother Lanny Poffo. Jimmy Valiant, the Valiants were big stars, over Ravishing Rick Rude. Okay. Tommy Rich, huge star, and Eddie Gilbert versus the Spoiler and Phil Hickerson in a Tennessee street fight, with Gilbert pinning Hickerson. The Fabulous Ones, another big tag team, over Coco Beware and Norville Austin. Then Jerry the King Lawler and Austin Idol over the Road Warriors, another huge. So that is an absolutely loaded card that Memphis ran against Vince there, and they sent him packing, basically. This was a huge victory for Memphis over Vince in the in this territorial era here, in this expansion era, you could say. And Vince, as far as I know, did not try to return to Memphis for some years. He really got his nose bloodied there. Then they ran Chicago. Now, I looked into the Chicago situation, and basically, I was correct. That was run by Dick the Bruiser and the WWA territory, but they were more or less defunct at this point. I think Crusher and Dick the Bruiser were doing a few dates for Vern Gagne. They were basically retired. So Chicago, like, Vince running that was basically a bit of an FU to Vern. But WWA was kind of gone at this point. Then we talked a lot about the Black Saturday stuff last time. All the extra I have on that is that the Omni shows didn't draw at all, and that Vince was so hard up for cash in the run up to WrestleMania that it is said that if he didn't have that $1 million from the Crockett's, he could have gone under. But what I didn't know, and I'll come back to, I might as well mention here, is that he'd cut a deal with New Japan Wrestling around this time, and they were basically, the deal was he would send stars over to Japan, you know, Hogan, Andre, whoever it was, who'd go and work their tours in exchange for a stipend. And they co-promoted a couple of titles. I think one of them was the WWF light heavyweight title. Dynamite Kid held it at one point. Basically, it is also said that the money that he got from New Japan all through this period basically kept him in business, because they were spending so much money in the run-up to WrestleMania and in the promotion of it and so on, that the New Japan deal and that $1 million from Crockett basically stopped the WWF going under in this time. So he made some pretty big risky moves in the run-up to WrestleMania in 1985, which is, few months from this time. Phoenix, we talked about. Yes, this date here, Oklahoma City, November 1984. Now, this was declaration of war on Bill Watts. And hold on a second. Before we get there, that Kansas City date in October 84. So what happened there? Because, like I said, that was Bob Geigel's office. Harley Race was a linchpin down there. What happened? How come Vince was suddenly cheekily trying to run Kansas City? Apparently, basically, he was just trying it on. Like, Vince was just being all out ballsy here and trying to send a message. And the only extra bit of detail I got on this Kansas date here in October is that that Harley Race was so angered by Vince coming in there that he had threatened to, you know, get into like a physical altercation with some of the WWF guys. And if anybody knows anything about Harley Race, that is not something you want to be involved with. So yeah, Harley was incensed. Clearly he wasn't that incensed because he ended up at the WWF a few years later as the King. Central States office was struggling. It was typically seen as like the worst of the NWA territories. Bob Geigel was nominally the president around this time, but in reality, because Jim Crockett Jr. controlled the champion Ric Flair, because he controlled the dates for the for Flair and so on, and because the Mid-Atlantic was the most powerful territory, Jim Crockett Jr., like de jure it was Geigel, but de facto it was Crockett. So really, this was the kind of low ebb for Central States anyway. Then Vince basically invades Bill Watts' territory, and I don't think that was without its receipts either. Let me just double check when exactly he ran that. Apparently, yes, same deal as Memphis, right? Vince ran the card in Oklahoma, okay? Dismal crowd, 1,500. That's a shitty crowd, even for Oklahoma City, okay? This was the card. Jimmy Snuka won a battle royale. Nikolai Volkov over SD Jones. Jimmy Snuka against David Schultz. Both big stars. Schultz was a kind of southern wrestling type guy. You should catch his promos from this era. They're hilarious. Bret Hart over Buddy Rose. There was a very young Bret Hart, of course. He'd come in from the Calgary deal. Jack and Jerry Briscoe over Brutus Beefcake and Johnny V. Sergeant Slaughter over the Iron Sheik. And the Junkyard Dog over Paul Orndorff. Now, that is a absolutely loaded card, especially for the Oklahoma market. JYD had been essentially the biggest star for Bill Watts, like the Hulk Hogan of the Mid-South area. Paul Orndorff had been a major star. Won the title down there for Watts, had programs with the DBRC and various others. So you can see Vince's thinking here: poach the talent, run the arena, and hopefully the star name of JYD and Orndorff would be enough to draw the gate. Didn't work. And this is something that Vince found out basically during this expansion era, which is that even though JYD had been a star for Watts, the fans of that area didn't see the WWF as their style of wrestling. So it doesn't matter if it's JYD. It's like, well, it's JYD for WWF. We don't really want to see that. Vince basically underestimated the extent to which each local wrestling market had conditioned their fans to a certain type of wrestling. You know, the Bill Watts style, the Mid-South style is very like, they worked a bit stiff. There's a lot of bloody brawls. You know, they pasted the shit out of each other. A bit of higher tempo, higher work rate. The WWF, very high standard of wrestling, great psychology, great storytelling. I mean, if you've never watched the Mid-South TV, I believe Vince owns that now. And most at one point, I remember it was on the network, on the WWE network. So, and it's worth watching week in, week out, because there are some tremendous matches, but also some great storytelling. You know, the Ted DiBiase, Jim Duggan feud, the tuxedo on a pole match, whatever it's called. The TV and the run up to that is just phenomenal. as is some of the other stuff, you know, some great stuff in Mid-South. So because of that, the fans of this area weren't going to just turn out to see, like, a JYD Paul Orndorff match for, you know, promoted by those kind of New York sissies. They didn't like that. They didn't like it. They didn't like the WWF product. There was also an aspect of, like, well, hold on a second. We can see these guys on TV. Like, we see the New York wrestling on cable if we want to, and it's just like, you know, it's not for us. We are the Mid-South fans. But let me just double check to see what Watts did, because apparently Bill Watts was absolutely furious at Vince running this card. And let me just pull up the results from 84 from Mid-South. Because he ran against Vince. He ran his own card against this, and similar to Memphis, he ran a really loaded card, gave a huge promotion, and basically ran Vince out of town. So he didn't try this again. Just give me a moment, my screen is frozen. Hold on. Buggeration. Come on. Something, my screen is frozen here, folks. Oh, here we go. I've got it back. I've got my cursor back. Okay. So, let's have a look. South Wrestling results. There we go. See what they ran against this. So Vince's card was on November the 29th. And Watts against that ran Superdome Extravaganza in New Orleans. So this was the card he ran in 1984. Hold on. So a week beforehand, he ran Hector and Chavo Guerrero against Master G and Brickhouse Brown, Adrian Street and Miss Linda B over Bill Dundee in a handicap match, you know, gimmick match like that, women in the ring, Jim Duggan and Butch Reed over Steve Williams and Ted DiBiase. Williams and DiBiase were huge stars. Duggan and Butch Reed were huge stars in this area. Rock and Roll Express over the Midnight Express. Huge match. Now, interesting, you know, you're like, well, the Rock and Roll Express, they were working Memphis just like a couple of months ago. Now they're in Mid-South. And that's what they used to do in these days. You know, Rock and Rolls would run they'd run for a bit of Memphis, then they'd run for a bit of Mid-South, then they'd go to Crockett, you know, like that. But anyway, Rock and Rolls, Watts booked them really well. Midnight Express, that was Jim Cornette's team. And as he'll tell you all day long, they were huge stars. So this would have been they sold the Superdome out many times. But it wasn't just the Rock and Rolls versus the Midnight Express. It was a scaffold match and a tag title match. So notice the stipulations and the gimmick matches that they're running basically to ensure that whatever Vince does, the fans in that area, you know, you've got only a certain amount of money. You're a wrestling fan, but you don't live your life. You know, you're only going to watch one show in the week or whatever. Do I go to New Orleans or do I go to this fucking WWF card? No, I'll go and see the Midnights versus the Rock and Rolls in a scaffold match, because, you know, if you know anything, that's a chance for the fans to see, like, Jim Cornette, you know, finally get his comeuppance or something like this. And then Magnum TA versus Ernie Ladd. Ernie Ladd, another tremendous talent. Magnum TA was a big star at this time, up and coming. That was for the North American Championship. So pretty strong, loaded card by Watts to put up against that. But I'm sure he also ran a spot show in Oklahoma that weekend. Let's see if I can find that. Was just the See if I can find that Oklahoma Mid-South Wrestling Alliance. Now I'm going on to Cage Match here to look for results. Have a look. Food wrestling results here exist. So anyway, the story that we're getting here, like last time we basically talked up how aggressive Vince was and how ruthless he was. But what I think you're seeing here is that not everything went his own way. And, you know, he can't just turn up. It's like, I think in his mind, he thought, well, I'll turn up, you know, the big dogs from New York gonna will turn up and, you know, fans will just flock to us. Didn't quite work like that. Each market had its own set of fans and they were loyal to the local promotion. They didn't want the New York wrestling. And I'm just seeing if Watts ran any house shows up against Vince there. Let's have a look. Give me a second. Yes, here we go. He ran. Here we go. Same night. Night beforehand, Louisiana, Monroe Center, Rock and Rolls against the Midnights, 28th of November in Mississippi, Rock and Rolls versus the Midnight. So that was going around the horn, basically. So, you know, if you were a fan in that area of that time, are you really gonna turn up to watch Junkyard Dog versus Paul Orndorff in a nothing WWF house show? Or are you gonna turn up and watch the Midnights versus the Rock and Rolls? I think you'll see that the fans went to the Midnights versus the Rock and Rolls. December 84, the Houston. Now, we talked about Paul Bosch last time, and essentially he sold the contract of it to Vince to promote Houston. There was a lot of jiggery pokery in Texas at this time. And one of the things I was not aware of is that the Von Erichs, Fritz Von Erich in particular, who ran Dallas, Vince kept on saying in various kind of press conferences that he and Fritz were coming to an agreement. And around this time, around November, December 84, Vince ran a press conference in New Japan where he basically said that that himself, President Shinma, who was the WWF president before Jack Tunney, Inoki and Fritz Von Erich had come together and between them were going to run 97% of wrestling around the world. Okay. Now, it turns out that there was no truth to this. Fritz Von Erich was an old school guy. He liked running Texas, he liked running Dallas. He had a good deal down there with his sons. Kevin Von Erich was apparently a homebody, didn't like traveling. He was the one who was most kind of office business minded out of the brothers. I think the David Von Erich had died at this point. In fact, if you watch the WWF TV in this period, they actually do Vince does the 10 bell salute for David Von Erich. It's announced by Joe McHugh, and I think it's on the last March Championship Wrestling or the first April one. So it was a kind of touching moment. They do a 10 bell salute and they pay their respects to David Von Erich. But that also, you know, more cynically, like for Vince to acknowledge a Texas guy, not one of his own wrestlers, on TV in that era when he was pulling these sorts of moves, was also basically sending the signal, oh, hold on, you know, McMahon is in touch with Von Erich. So the upshot of this is that even though Fritz Von Erich, in fact, it's kind of similar to what it's kind of similar to what's happening with Putin at the moment in geopolitics. Like, I mean, for all anybody knows, and for what it seems like, Putin does not want to invade Ukraine or has no plans to do this. He's just minding his own business. And it seems like Fritz von Erich had no plans whatsoever to expand, to join with Vince, to do anything. He just wanted to run his own little territory, and he was just happy doing that. But Vince, by making these insinuations, by continually talking about things like this in press conferences, by acknowledging the death of David on air, things like that, was basically sowing confusion and paranoia among all of the other promoters, who kept on looking over their shoulder, wondering what Fritz was up to. Oh, what's Fritz up to? You know, and this was going on all through this time. So a lot of what was happening. So if you can imagine, all the other promoters could have really ganged up against Vince, okay, to stop him pulling these sorts of moves that he was doing. And when they did so, as you saw in Memphis and as you saw in Oklahoma, when they were organized and when they put up a united front, they could put on a card to stop Vince expanding into a territory, as we saw. But because of the paranoia that he was sowing amongst them, there was a lot of infighting. There was a lot of backbiting. There was a lot of people like quitting promotions. There was a lot of distrust, basically, between the other promoters. So this was one of like Vince's tactics to sow seeds of confusion and division among the opponents. And really, in many cases, he didn't need to do anything. He just needed to sit back and wait for them to punch each other out. And that's kind of how he used Fritz in this era. Now the Houston deal was a little bit separate from all of that. It just so happened he got to Bosch before the others. But I think some of that paranoia in the run-up to Vince running Houston may have contributed to Paul Bosch going with Vince, especially if you remember, like, you know, how it would have looked down there. It would have been like, well, it's not just Vince turning up. It's Vince. It's Jack Briscoe, who Bosch would have worked with, you know, back when he was the champion. It's, George Scott, who had massive respect in the industry. Pat Patterson would be there. So it's not like they see, like, oh, this is a group of outsiders coming in. By that point, Bosch would have been like, okay, well, I'll leave Houston in safe hands here. I trust these guys. Basically, they're gonna do me proud. You know, I remember the Briscoes, but blah blah blah. So you've got to understand some of the backstage politics here. Whereas he would have looked over to see what, you know, his old mates in the NWA were doing, and it's like, hold on, you know, Watts is worried about the Von Erichs. The Von Erichs, I don't know what they're up to. You know, Geigel is worried about Crockett. All of this sort of stuff, and it's like, well, who are you going to go with? I don't think it's that difficult to understand Paul Bosch's decision against that sort of context. All right, June 85. Now, if you remember last time, I was wondering how come Vince waited to run? How come he waited until 85 to run the Cow Palace in San Francisco? What I didn't know is that Vern had been running San Francisco. The AWA had been running San Francisco in the early 80s. But he didn't have much success there running cards. I mean, I think Nick Bockwinkel had like old school ties going back to that territory. Don't quote me on that, but I think Bockwinkel had some West Coast connections there. When Bobby the Brain was still there, he had worked San Francisco some. But for whatever reason, Vern was not able to break San Francisco. So as soon as Vince had the chance, as soon as that contract was up, he swooped in and was like, well, I'll fucking run it instead then. Now, I'm not sure if the AWA carried on trying to run San Francisco during this time. Let me just pull up AWA results for 1985. In the back of my mind, I'm thinking that the AWA started running Las Vegas rather than San Francisco. Like in the, oh, here we go. So here are some cars that the AWA ran. Yeah, see, they were still running San Francisco. They ran the Cow Palace in February 84. They only drew 3,500 then. You just do a control F for Cow Palace. So they were still running it in 84. They ran it every month in 84, every single month. But the crowd are dismal, you know. 1,600. This is in July of 84. What car did Vern Gagne run? Jim Brunzel over King Kong Brody. Fabulous Ones over Nick Bockwinkle and Sato. Road Warriors versus Steve-O and Kurt Hennig. Tony Atlas over Steve Regal. And Billy Robinson over Larry Zbysko. I mean, it's a pretty loaded car, to be honest. But the fans didn't want to know. 1,600. So clearly there's something about the promotion of that. I can see here they were running the Showboat Pavilion in Las Vegas at the same time. They ran TV on Minneapolis. They ran Salt Lake City. They ran Denver. They were doing dates up in Montreal. They ran Milwaukee, Rosemont in Illinois. So, you know, you can see that the AWA was still like running a lot of shows. Look at this card here. This is August 84. 800. They drew 800 at the Cow Palace. Kurt Hennig over Steve Regal in the main event. Jim Brunzel against Sheik Adnan. That was Adnan Al-Kasi. Tony Atlas over Larry Zbysko. Road Warriors over the Crusher. Baron von Raschke. Mr. Sato over Stan Lane. I mean, they're not... You see, the thing is that there's names. All of these are stars on the San Francisco cards. But, I mean, these crowds are awful. September 84. AWA at the Cow Palace. AWA champion Rick Martel over Mr. Sato. Non-title match. Tia Koala versus Jerry Monty, nothing match. Kurt Hennig over Larry Zbysko. Fabulous Ones over Billy Robinson and Nick Bockwinkle. Jim Brunzel and Tony Atlas over the Road Warriors. Attendance 600. So you could see these crowds are going down every month. Every month they were running it, and every month it was bad. Then I can see in November they managed to draw 6,800 at the Cow Palace. So why the bump in the gate then? There was a lot of no-shows on this card. Billy Robinson, Tony Atlas, Larry Zbysko, Baron von Raschke, The Crusher, and Jim Brunzel were all no-shows for this 6,800 card at the Cow Palace. Jerry Blackwell and Boom Boom Bundy won a battle royale. King Kong Brody over Jerry Blackwell. Blackjack Lanza over Paul Ellering. Nick Bockwinkle over Steve Kern, Mr. Sato over Steve-O, Jimmy Garvin over Jerry Monty. Now, that is an atrocious card, terrible card. And I'm guessing that the fact that the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 stars no-showed that card after 6,800 people showed up probably is what shit the bed for the AWA in the Cow Palace. And I can see they didn't run the Cow Palace after that. So I don't know if they had a lot of refunds after that show, but it seems like whatever happened then destroyed Cow Palace for Vern. I can see there's a December date. Jimmy Garvin and Rick Martel. That's the only result. Attendance 1,200. So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty dismal. They carried on running it into 85. They carried on running it. I can see. That's it. That last date they have is May. So what I'm guessing happened here is that Vern must have lost the contract with the Cow Palace. And, you know, things like no shows, things like, you know, mis-selling tickets, putting no title matches on there. I mean, it's a pretty good card, that the the card, the May 85 card, Sergeant Slaughter and Larry Hennig versus Kurt and Kurt Hennig against the Road Warriors and Paul Ellering in a cage match. Loaded. I think I've seen that match. It's pretty good. Jerry Blackwell against Sheik Adnan, Baron Von Raschke against Jimmy Garvin, Steve Regal. That's not William Regal that you guys may know. It's Mr. Electricity Steve Regal versus Buck Zumoff. Less said about him, the better. Brad Rannigan's over Butch Reed and Samula against Drew Tossel. So it seems like they ran the Cow Palace every single month with indifferent gates. Sometimes they'd get up to 6,000-7,000, but there seems to be a lot of no-shows on this on these cards. And I'm guessing that at some point the local promoter there, whoever ran the contract for the Cow Palace, was like, listen, I'm going to go with Vince instead because, you know, at least he shows up, or at least he sells what's on the card. So, and I can see that Vern, basically after this point, they make a deal with Jarrett, and they make this promotion called Pro Wrestling USA. It's not really a promotion. It's like a kind of co-promotion thing where they run, where they're able to kind of cross-promote cards. So, as an example, they do a Pro Wrestling USA taping in Minneapolis, where you've got, you know, Jerry Lawler and Rick Martel and the Road Warriors, who are all AWA stars, on the same card as the Fabulous Freebirds, who are at Memphis at this time. Who else have you got there? Lawler on that card. So they're basically like co-promoting, you know, and that, yes. I can also see that Vern is running Chicago as well at this time. So he's drawing, like, for example, he ran a Chicago show in May, and that was headlined. That was Jerry Blackwell and Slaughter against Road Warrior Animal and Paul Ellering. That was a sub for Hawk, who obviously was injured or, you know, high on drugs or whatever. And I can see Terry Gordy no-showed for that card. So I don't know. If you're understanding you're an AWA fan at this time and you keep on paying your good money to, you know, turn up to see the wrestling, and then, you know, continually guys are no-showing cards, it's probably going to annoy fans, I'd imagine. All right. Anything else before I get out of here? Pensacola and Tampa. I mean, the Florida was a market, as far as I can see, that stayed strong. I mean, he tried it on there. You got to understand that in the markets where Gordon Soley was the commentator, a lot of the fans like saw it as, quote, Gordon Soley wrestling. So they were used to a very different style of presentation. Gordon Soley would treat wrestling as kind of legit. You know, he had a lot of gravitas, and the Florida, like the Eddie Graham's promotion, they had Dusty, who had a bit of, you know, he was good on promos, and they ran a few hot angles and things like that. But there was a very heavy focus in Florida on legitimacy. And of course, Vince's product was a lot more cartoonish. And as far as I can see, he kind of got like the Crockett, the Florida situation is a bit messy because after it was sold up, Dusty starts running it again. You know, it's CWF, and then there's Championship Wrestling from Florida, something like that. And we talked about Eddie Graham's death last time. Florida stays fairly loyal to WCW, I would suggest. But there is a Hogan connection because, of course, he's from Miami Beach, Florida. So Hogan used this kind of the hometown star is coming home thing. He used it in LA. He used it in the Twin Cities, you know, and he used it in, you know, Minneapolis, St. Paul. He used it for that area, and he used it for Florida as well. So he, like, I mean, you know, yes. You can see this war with Watts still goes on. It's just a battle of two egos, basically, like Vince's ego versus Bill Watts's. But Vince was never going to win that. He was never in a million years going to win a battle with a cowboy in his backyard going head to head when, you know, Watts is living and breathing the Oklahoma kind of Mid-South area. Just no chance to get in there. The Portland deal with Don Owen, I actually discovered something about this as well, which is that Rowdy Roddy Piper, who, as I talked about last time, was very, very loyal to Don Owens because he made his name up in Portland. Also, for a period, Buddy Rose was working in for Vince as Mr. X. If you remember at the first WrestleMania, there's a Mr. X on the card. That is Buddy Rose. Very funny story about Buddy Rose, which is that he got done. Buddy Rose got done during this period for tax evasion because he didn't file his taxes because he was working as Mr. X under a mask and not as Buddy Rose. And so he thought that he could get away with not doing his tax returns because the tax man would be looking for Mr. X and not Buddy Rose. So just a funny little detail. But anyway, Piper's loyalty to Don Owen was so absolute, and Piper was such an important star, that Piper used his leverage to basically ensure that Piper could go back and do like spot appearances on Portland shows. So because of Piper, Vince and Don Owen in Portland had like cordial relations. It's not like they were at peace or they were allied or anything like that. They were just cordial. They were not at war, okay? And it was things like this, which also, because Vince was friendly with some guys and totally at war with others, he could use the fact that Don Owen, for example, was not quite on board with the other NWA guys to his advantage. So he did play divide and conquer. And in this case, that was largely thanks to Rowdy Roddy Piper, who, for example, I think there was a Don Owen memorial card around this time. Let me just, I'm sure I saw those results somewhere. Don Owen memorial card. Give me a second. I'm sure I saw those on Clawmasters AWA results somewhere. Here we go. This was the Don Owen 60th anniversary show at Portland, Oregon. Okay. Now look, now watch this card here. It's so interesting. Okay. NWA champion Ric Flair drew with Billy Jack Haynes. Billy Jack Haynes, incidentally, he never quite made his name, but around this time, he was heavily pimped in the Aptamags. He was often a front cover star. And for some reason, the kind of wrestling fandom was trying to make Billy Jack Haynes a big star. It never quite worked out that way. Anyway, Ric Flair, NWA champion, over Billy Jack Haynes. AWA champion, Rick Martel, over Mike Miller. So you've got the AWA champ, Martel, and the NWA champ, Ric Flair, on the same card. Kurt Hennig and Larry Hennig over AWA Tag Team Champions, the Road Warriors, DQ. Roddy Piper beat Buddy Rose. So Roddy Piper, of course, WWF star, working this date for Portland Wrestling on an anniversary show, but still he was there. And yet he's appearing on a card with Flair and Martel, even though Flair was Crockett guy, Martel was a Vern guy, and Piper was a Vince guy. So the very fact that this card happened like this is really quite fascinating. Sergeant Slaughter over Kendo Nakazaki, various other kind of lesser lights there. But it's just interesting that, you know, this Portland show happened, and that they were able to do this. But it wasn't just at that cut. It wasn't just at that Portland show that you had this sort of thing going on. For example, in September of that year, Flair worked Magnum TA. NWA champion Ric Flair over Magnum TA. AWA tag team champions Road Warriors over Sergeant Slaughter and Billy Jack Haynes. Ivan Koloff and Krusha Khrushchev against Bobby Jaggers and Steve Pardee. I mean, what was Ivan Koloff doing up there? You know, Rusey Brody over Jesse Barr. So it's kind of very interesting, some of these Portland cards that they were able to run. And Piper, you know, he made occasional appearances at these sorts of things, just out of pure loyalty to Don Owens. So just to go to show you how much these backstage politics affect actually who appeared on these shows. Okay. What else have we got? Speaking of Vern Gagne, I also found out a little story that Vern had run a battle royale, and this was, you know, of all the people that Vince was at war with, yes, he was at war with Bill Watts and with Jarrett in Memphis, but the person he really declared war on was Vern, and he always had it in for Vern for some reason. You know, stole all of his talent, ran head-to-head with him. Like, for some reason, he just seemed to have it in for Gagne. One of the things he did is that Vern ran a battle royale. I can't remember exactly what it was, but the battle royale had a stipulation that the winner would win $50,000 at the battle royale. And basically, Vince leaked a story in the media that this wrestler had not filed tax returns. Maybe he used the real life Buddy Rose situation as inspiration for this. He basically leaked a story in the media, like the mainstream media. This wrestler, whoever it happened to be, hasn't filed his tax returns and owes this much money. Will Vern Gagne pay it? So basically, has Vern Gagne given this prize money to this wrestler and then expected the wrestler to file the tax returns, which he hasn't done? Now, of course, in reality, Vern Gagne had not given that wrestler 50 grand. It was kayfabe. It was just fabric. It was just a storyline bullshit. These were the sorts of mind games Vince was playing with his opponents, like just leaking that story in the press created a bit of a PR problem for Vern, who was an old school guy. He always wanted to protect the business. Like, now it put Vern in a bind. Does he have to really give this guy 50 grand? Is he going to have to declare the money to the IRS, etc.? So, you know, it's kind of fascinating that he was able to play these kind of childish sort of games when he was in the middle of, you know, a pretty substantial kind of business expansion that we've been talking about. Really fascinating. I found out a few other things as well. That date in Honolulu, Hawaii, is a little bit surprising. Apparently, The Rock's father, Rocky Johnson, he was involved in the Honolulu territory, the Hawaii territory, which was part-time. And another person who was a mainstay of that area was Don the Rock Morocco. Don Morocco. If you remember, Don Morocco was a big guy. He was managed by Mr. Fuji for a time. He was the Intercontinental Champion for a time. He kind of put on a bit of weight over the years. But like Don Morocco, he could have been like a massive star. He was kind of a big star, but he was just not that motivated. And Don Morocco insisted that every year he has to take a certain amount of time out to to just like laze on the beach in Hawaii. So he'd work like a few dates for Hawaii in this part-time promotion and laze around on the beach, basically. So this was the Honolulu promotion. But that area had always been run by the Maivias, you know, like that area had always been run by the Maivias. That now you may be thinking, well, that's the Rocks family. But that's the Rocks family on the mother's side, like the Samoans. The Samoan family were always called the Maivias. You know, the Samoans, Afa and Sika, were part of the Maivia family. Rikishi Fatu was part of the Maivia family. Who else was part of the Maivia family? There was the famous one who worked Madison Square Garden quite a lot, was the main guy down there. So the Maivia wrestling family. Peter Maivia. Peter Maivia was like the main business head. Well, anyway, he had died in 1982, and the Rocks' mother-in-law. The Rocks' mother's mother. So the Rocks' grandmother had taken over the wrestling business, and obviously his daughter was married to Rocky Johnson. Of, you know, who was the black guy who was part of the tag team with Tony Atlas that we saw. Well, for some reason, Rocky Johnson wasn't happy with this arrangement and basically went on his own and declared his own promotion, like Rocky Johnson did. He owned a gym in Hawaii. A lot of wrestlers own their own gyms. I think Don Morocco had his own gym there. Rocky Johnson had his own gym there as well. What happened was that Rocky Johnson declared war on his wife's mother, leading Rocky Johnson to get a divorce with the Rock's mother, if that makes any sense. She sided with the family, he sided with himself. And this Honolulu date in 1986 is something to do with this Rocky Johnson connection running against the Maivias. So convoluted story, but you know, you learn a lot of weird things. Last thing I'll look at before we wrap up for today is this New Orleans card in March 86. Just kind of interested, in what that card was, and you know, that's presumably the Superdome in New Orleans. Let's have a look. New Orleans, baby, with the Superdome, 12,600. That's a very, very good card for Vince. The card was Hillbilly Jim versus Iron Mike Sharp, King Kong Bundy against Lanny Poffo, Uncle Elmer against Jesse the Body Ventura. That's a very late date for Ventura to be working. He didn't work many dates after 84 because he got injured and had blood clots, but that must have been like part of a ill-fated return for Jesse. Then Greg Valentine and Brutus Beefcake over Davey Boy Smith and the Dynamite Kid. That's the British Bulldogs. Absolutely loaded card so far. Junkyard Dog pinned Terry Funk. Huge match. That was a well promoted angle, of course. Fans in New Orleans would have known Terry Funk, they knew Junkyard Dog. But the difference is, this had like TV time behind it, this had been built. And then WWF World Champion Hulk Hogan pinned the Iron Sheik. One of the little dirty tricks I know that Bill Watts pulled in the run up to this Superdome show is that, Watts liked to. From his archives, he'd show footage of like Iron Sheik when he was working for Mid-South being pinned on TV. So he would run TV shows of WWF talent being pinned, you know, from like some show in 1983-84. He'd show old footage basically just to try to expose the workers and to say, well, they're not all that. Look, when he was here, he was beaten by, you know, Magnum TA or whatever. So that was a promotional tactic that Watts used. We're going to have to wrap up in a second, I think. Let me just double check to see what Watts did against this 86 version of the invasion, because that's a pretty good date. That's a pretty good gate for Vince. It has to be said, they ran So they ran the Superdome on March the 7th. And from what I can see, Bill Watts didn't run the Superdome in March of that year. I wonder what happened. Running in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Mississippi, Sam Houston Coliseum, Houston, Lafayette. Yeah. Oh, there we go. Lakefront Arena in New Orleans. They ran Arn Anderson versus Dusty Rhodes in a steel cage match. Rock and Rolls versus the Midnight Express. Sorry, the Rock and Roll Express versus the Midnight Express. NWA tag team match. I Quit match. Jim Duggan versus Buzz Sawyer. Dick Slater versus Terry Taylor. Jack Victory versus Ricky Gibson. And the Sheepherders over... That's the Bushwhackers, you'll know them as, over Perry Jackson and Tracy Smothers. Ah, interesting. Wonder why they were running the Lakefront Arena and what sort of gate that got. I do know that they had started to struggle by that time. Let me just double check the gate for that, because here we go. This was it. Do not have an attendance. Don't have an attendance for that. So, but of course they were, I think they were UWF by then. Well, I think by 86, Watts had started running into financial trouble as well. So just goes to show you that a couple of years chipping away at it. Vince eventually managed to break New Orleans look in 86. Also goes to show you, like, the Rock and Rolls versus the Midnights, like, it's 86 now. They've been running that Rock and Roll Express versus the Midnight Express basically for 2 years round the horn. So maybe fans were starting to think, well, this is getting a bit old, you know. I tell you if anybody in the world has the attendance numbers for that New Orleans date in 86, it would be Jim Cornette. So if anybody watches Jim Cornette, say, listen, I was watching The Academic Age, and I'd love to know, Jim, what was the attendance for that? And what was the story about Vince running the Superdome in March of 86? And why did Watts run in the arena and not in the Superdome? And what was the attendance figure? All right, I think I'm going to have to get out of here. My guest has not arrived, but I'm going to go and look for them. Any super chats that come in, I'll deal with them later. In the words of Ed Dutton, goodbye. Buy my courses, join the channel, buy a mug, most importantly of all,